deepening spirituality and cultivating soul in all aspects of his life have led Thomas More into academia, religion, spirituality, and the arts. Thomas has crafted his art in writing many books, most recently, A Religion of One's Own. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm really happy that you're interested in this book.
It seems a perfect segue to go from Care of the Soul, and I know there was a book in between there, but into A Religion of One's Own. Why did you choose the word religion instead of spirituality for the title of this book?
That's really a good question. You know, a lot of people were encouraging me to use spirituality. Well, I just like religion, you know. I think it means something more than spirituality. It's a little more definite, more about practice. And it relates, more important, I guess, it relates to the tradition. So what I'm trying to suggest is kind of reimagining how we understand religion coming from where we have been, you know. So I wanted to have that idea in there that I'd like to revise and deepen our sense of what religion is so that we could you know, have it again and feel good about it.
In saying, just as you did, coming from where we have been, are you talking about, okay, we've come from a long tradition, perhaps of Judaism or Catholicism, or are you talking about coming from where we have been, taking that time, like where have I been in my life? You have your path and traditions that have intersected with your path, and I have mine. So elaborate a little bit about coming from where we have been.
Okay, good. Well, I was thinking probably, first of all, of the tradition. So we have had a lot of religious traditions, you know, as you say, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and Indian, various religions of India, and then the rest of the world. There's just so much there. I have a PhD in religion, which means that I love religions. You know, I just think there's so much beauty and wisdom in them that we don't have to reinvent anything. What we can do is rediscover what's there and be inspired and educated by what's there. So that's where I feel we've come from. But the trouble is that those organizations, those traditions, in many instances, have become institution heavy. You know, they become more absorbed in themselves, getting membership and making sure everyone thinks alike, and really have become obstacles, I think, to the religious life of people rather than resources and support. So that's what I mean by reimagining. I'd like to look at religion now and say, well, I may want to go to the local Lutheran church because I know that they can give me a piece of my spiritual life that I need, their resources. I don't have to join. I don't have to, you know, sell my soul to it. I think we could have a new, fresh way of relating to the traditions and benefit from that.
Yes, as you said, institution heavy. I don't think any institution that has formed has not become institution heavy just by the fact that it becomes more interested or more concerned with the continuation of the institution. And I'm not just talking about religious institutions here. I just think it's, you know, an inevitability, actually.
Yes, it's like an inherent tendency within the thing itself. I think also there is this tendency within the spiritual altogether in a kind of a broad way, because whenever you get people together to try to create some sort of spiritual community or spiritual, you know, togetherness, very, very often it slips into some kind of hierarchical pyramid style of organization, and people, you know, become leaders and followers. And that's why I'm calling this A Religion of One's Own, with that echo of Virginia Woolf in the background, is that I think it's time to do exactly what she was trying to do, and that is to get people to not to give up on tradition and not to go it alone totally in total solitude, but to make some decisions and use our own individual intelligence and streamline, make all of these opportunities, these resources, make them fit who we are as individuals, each of us individuals. We haven't done that. The traditions pretty much have asked everyone to be the same. They don't like individuality generally. And so I'm moving against that tendency.
Yes, good move. How does a religion become irrelevant? And perhaps what you were just saying is the main problem, but I'm wondering what else you have to say about that. And do you think the fact that fundamentalists end up appearing, and it's happened in many, many religions, not just the obvious ones that might come to mind, do you think that the fear is a problem, or is it just a real disconnect with what the essence of that religion is that might create that fundamentalist?
Well, like most things, like most of our social problems today, but one of the difficulties is a lack of deep education. You know, a lot of people have taken up with a religious tradition, and they really haven't studied it. You know, they've just been given sort of the surface ideas on it. And that leads them open to being led around by it and not using their own intelligence. That's one of the problems. And related to that, I think this is another main issue, the religions are talking about mysteries, things that are impossible to define and resolve, and they shouldn't be resolved. Things like, what is afterlife, you know, and how do we deal with the problems in love, and what do you do when you get really seriously ill, and how do you raise children? I mean, these are all issues that the churches and the religions have addressed. But the trouble is, these issues are so deep and mysterious that they require a poetic way of talking. And many, many, if not like 99% of religious texts are spiritual poetry. But the average person doesn't get that, you know, doesn't get poetry. There's facts, you know, just one fact or another fact. It's either right or wrong. And the churches and the religions generally haven't taught that the poetry aspect of it. That takes a certain sophistication of thinking, you know, to be able to think that way. And I see this happening over again in so many different traditions. So I think that is one of the key differences. If we could think more and understand the genre in which religious talk takes place, we'd be better off.
Well, you are certainly someone who has had that experience. I believe you did translate the gospel, yes?
I haven't published them yet, but yes, I translated the Gospels of the New Testament. I translated from Greek. I studied Greek when I was living in a monastery, so I had a few years of, you know, that's a very simple Greek. So I did translate the Gospels, and I did them because I also have studied in my doctoral studies. I focused on Greek mythology. I call it Greek spiritual literature, and. And so I know some of that Greek background. When I look at the New Testament, I see it there. I see it in there, but I feel that the New Testament, the Gospels, have been mistranslated in so many important and serious central ways that I wanted to put my two cents into it.
Yes, well, I'm excited to have you talk a little bit about that, Thomas, because I think what you're talking about is. You're dead on as far as that goes. And so I'm wondering, what was that process like for you, and how do you feel it looks or feels different than other translations? I mean, the Greek was not the language used when the Gospels were written originally. So the fact that you know some of their mythology, I think, would be, some pretty compelling conversation.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you an example. Maybe that would help.
Great.
There's one key word in the Gospels, keeps coming up in many different ways. A lot of people know it, metanoia. It's usually translated repentance, to repent. And But the word itself is an interesting word. Metta means to move beyond, and noia is a very classic philosophical word that means that the world has a certain order to it. It's not chaos, and that a human being has the capacity to perceive that order and live with it and in accord with it. Now, that's my translation of the word metanoia, a whole paragraph. But you see the difference between what I just said and repentance. Repentance puts it in the moralistic realm, or at least the ethical realm. You're repenting because you've done something wrong. I'm saying metanoia means a shift in the way you understand how the world works and how your place in that world, a primary shift in it. And I think that's what the Gospels are about. They're not about, feeling guilty about your behavior or, behave better or anything like that, which has really laid a huge guilt trip on people who follow it. Rather, this key word is saying you've got to shift in the way you understand yourself and the way you look at the world. This is what this whole Gospel is about. And if you can make that shift, you're going to be a much happier person.
I think in finding that moving beyond a certain world order, we do come into a religion of our own because we become guided. There's a difference, in a way, even between seeking and being guided. Maybe that's just a mincing of words. I don't know.
No, I don't think so at all. Seeking, I think, is a rather painful place to be. I mean, I meet seekers all the time, and I have been in a place in my own life when I was seeking, and I'm glad I'm not there anymore.
Yeah, ditto.
but it's can be disorienting to be in that seeker's place. On the other hand, it's freeing, and for a lot of people, it represents a stage in which they are no longer captive in someone else's idea of how they should think and behave. So it can be a liberating thing, but also challenging and not so happy. So being guided, I think, is very good. And this is why I think we have so many resources, not only the religious traditions themselves, but, I'll tell you one thing. This book of mine here was originally a book about the Transcendentalists of New England, because Emerson and Thoreau and Emily Dickinson went their own way. They opted consciously against a tradition, in Emerson's case and in Emily Dickinson's case, in which they grew up and where many of their friends and people around them were still, in it. So they went their own way. And there's just one statement after another from Thoreau and from Emerson, from all of them, that is exactly in tune with this book. So, that's a resource. All that writing of the Transcendentalists. If you read Walden or Thoreau's notes that he wrote before he wrote Walden, or as he was, writing, you'll find all kinds of suggestions of how to be a religious person in your own way, whether or not that is connected to a tradition.
Yes, and I noticed in the final chapter of A Religion of One's Own, you mention Yeats and a line from the Second Coming. Things yeah. fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. What was so striking to you about that, and how do you see the relevance for today's world?
Well, that's such a big question, because it has to do with my relationship to Ireland, which is very close. I spent a lot of time there, and I've been going there all my life. So Ireland has a big impact on me, and Yeats in particular, because, when I was a young man, I met a friend of Yeats, and I never met Yeats himself. He died before I was born, but I met a friend of his, and that had a big impact on me, that connection. And Yeats himself was someone who went his own way all his life, and really had to be a strong person to do it. It was a struggle for him, and yet he remained close to his vision. And in his poetry and his writings are like the sacred literature of his own religion. That's how I look at it. So to me, Yeats is really an important figure. And as he is trying to explore all these things, he writes these lines that I've heard for many, many years, about the center cannot hold, and a mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. That's in a way where we are. We're always in that place, in a way, either individually or collectively. as a society, where we feel that the center is not holding and things are really getting out of hand. So I think that it takes a spiritual outlook in order to resolve it. For example, another example would be that anarchy can be seen as the natural world right now. We're really killing the planet. And people don't want to look at that. They don't want to change as a result. They don't want to adjust to it and do something. And that's a situation that calls for a religion of one's own. I would say you have to you have to develop yourself to the point where you can really feel for the planet instead of just your own immediate needs. And if we arrived at that point, I think we'd be like Yeats. We could learn from Yeats how to do that.
I think it's interesting that people always want to make it about them. And everyone goes on and on about how the world is today. And I'm not convinced. I just feel like that's a myopic view. I'm not convinced it's so different than any other time in history. The players change, and of course the situations change, but it's always been the same in that sense of people are rebelling, people are at war, etc. And it just reminded me of an event. The University of Colorado every year has something called the Conference on World Affairs, and there was a panel one year that were brought in to speak about the 1960s. The three gave their sometimes funny, sometimes serious little presentations, and then the last guy just started talking, and everything he said was so dead on. And then he said, oh my gosh. And then after I wrote all this up, I realized they weren't talking about the 1860s. They wanted about the 1960s. So, and yet the whole entire audience was with him about the 1960s. And to make another segue here, the arts, I think that's how the arts can play such a big piece. You know, you've spoken about these beautiful poets and writers that do bring that out in not only a beautiful lyrical way, but in a way that kind of transfixes us and kind of holds us into a larger space.
Well, absolutely. That's a great story, by the way. I love that story of the 1860s. The poets, I think that in a secular society, we don't know what to do with the arts. In other societies that weren't so secular, the arts were directly connected to religion, not just as an institution, but because the arts can serve as portals to the infinite and the eternal, the timeless, timeless matters, things, the mysteries that we can't really articulate completely. The arts are good at that, you know, and artists have a talent to be able to do that. I think we need them in order to go deep enough. If we don't have the arts, we become these brains, walking brains, you know, and then we resolve everything rationally, or we try to figure everything out rationally. The poets and the arts take us deep, and you know, they tend to live in a way that's not quite so rational either. They tend to live with intuition, and their lives don't make a whole lot of sense from the normal point of view. And behind my work and talking about this religion of one's own, I talk about intuition and the arts, and suggest that in order to get along in this world as a religious person, you don't want to be quite so rational about everything. Don't figure everything out, but account for mystery and respect the mysteries that are around us and use poetic language and ritual for it. So, and you walk around not quite fully alert, you know, like, because you're in a poetic state of mind and you're following signs and intuitions. I think it's a different way of being, and we need that because our rationalism is making us dry and distancing us from our deepest feelings and our awareness that's so deep.
Yeah. When you were a monk, you were a monk for quite a few years, did you know that it was not going to be for life, or was there a point, and what do you think created that point to come out of that?
I thought it would be for life, yes. I took what were called solemn vows, which meant you take these for life, and it's a big deal to get out of them. So yeah, I really thought I was going to be for life. On the other hand, I often say that what the inspiration, the sense that I had that got me into it, was the same kind of thing that got me out of it. I just woke up one day and felt that I don't have that anymore. I don't have that beckoning to do this work anymore. So I have to be true to what's going on in me. I have to leave.
I like the fact that you had in your book a part about the mystics, and certainly they've been with us throughout all time. And because you've been so steeped in religious and spiritual history and studies, I'm wondering if you could share a story that you learned about someone from years gone by and why they would be considered a mystic.
Well, there are a lot of stories. First of all, I think one of my favorite mystics is Emily Dickinson. You know, I really believe she was a mystic. But there are many others, and there's one who's the most favorite of mine. He's a real intellectual. His name was Nicholas of Cusa. Not many people know about him. He was born in 1402, so it was a while ago. And one day he was out on a boat. He was on a ship, and in the middle of the night, and he had a mystical experience as though he was just swept away from himself. He wasn't even present. And when he came to, he had this insight that he had to know what he was ignorant about, what he could never know in his lifetime. And he sat down and wrote a book called On Cultivating Your Ignorance. And to me, that's been my guiding book, you know, from this mystic. And I've tried to follow him in my own work, to in everything I write, to know what I don't know and not to say anything that comes out of my ignorance or my, covers over my ignorance or my lack of knowledge. I want to preserve the mysteries, things that we can't know and shouldn't know. And I think, when I talk to the average person today, the professionals especially, they want to know everything, and they think they will know everything. I had doctors tell me once when I was giving them a lecture that I was totally wrong about this mysticism. They said that we're going to know everything about medicine in 20 years. I thought, what? This is where secularism is taking us.
Well, they
no
may
room
know.
For the mystic.
Yeah, they may know about medicine, but I'm not convinced they'll know a whole lot about healing if that's what their focus
yeah,
is.
Yeah, no, that's right. the whole thing is a mystery, and we have to treat it that way, even for our own health.
Yeah. When you were speaking about mystics, you recognized their ability to be so open as to stretch beyond the usual small and protective ego. Could you elaborate on that a little?
Mystics have the capacity to lose themselves in a positive way. They lose themselves. We can lose ourselves in a psychotic way. That's not very good. But to lose yourself in a positive way is to lose your sense of self suddenly, like for a period of time. It's a limited period of time. It might even be a very short time. You may have had the experience in just being in nature where you lost sense of time, or working at something, or listening to music or something, where you lose time and you get lost for a while. Then you feel yourself coming back. That's a mystical experience. I don't think it has to be huge. It just can be an ordinary, everyday experience. So that loss of self, the tradition says, for hundreds and hundreds of years, have said that loss of self is really healthy for the soul. They call it a vacation. It's like the soul taking a vacation from the rigors of life. That is necessary in a way. So I'm saying that every person should cultivate their mystical potential in their own way, because not everybody does it in the same way. For me, it's playing the piano, playing certain kinds of music on the piano. I go away. I'm gone. And it's a positive thing. And I would recommend that to anybody, but you have to do it in your own way, because my method is not going to work for anyone else.
When you talk about Simone Weil, is that how you pronounce the last name?
Yes.
She demonstrated that a religion of one's own is more than an intellectual piecing together of a puzzle culled from the traditions. And I'm wondering, how was it for you writing this book? You are so steeped and knowledgeable about the arts, and you know that's a good way to go. How do you stay out of the intellectual process while writing a book such as A Religion of One's Own? Was that a concern, or were you alert about that, or was that even present in your process?
Are you saying that that I might slip into a purely intellectual approach, you know, as I'm writing this? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I just mean when you know people are going to be reading your work and knowing what a non-intellectual process spirituality is, I would think it would be difficult to write a book like this where you don't want to say, okay, well, here's how it's done, or here are how this isn't done, and think about this and all of that. Yeah,
I understand better now what you're saying. Yes. Well, you know, my own ability is not in poetry. I write a little bit of poetry, but it's really not good. You know, I wouldn't make it public. But I do. I seem to have a talent or an ability to write about ideas in a way that is not academic, and that's been my genre, you might say. It's what I've discovered. I didn't know it, but I discovered that this probably is the best way for me to do it. It's what I naturally do. So to me, that's my poetry, and there is a lot of non-rationality in it. I mean, it's, even though it is writing about ideas, I pay close attention to the way the book is shaping up and to the language I use and to writing a sentence and writing paragraphs. I always play music and I play on the piano before I write. I read my favorite writers. Writers, I think, are the best stylists before I write, so that I'm not in a purely rational place. I'm more interested in the writing than I am in the ideas, to some extent. I guess the weight would fall more toward the poetry of it rather than the ideas. And that keeps me in that place I think we need to be. I don't want to be anti-intellectual at all, but I do want to explore ideas, which I like to do, but in a way that is freer and not so heavy in an academic sense.
Yes. Do you have a book in particular right now, or one that perhaps is always by your side?
Well, when I write, I always read Hemingway for style. I like the way he writes sentences, really clear, straight, and very, very beautiful in sound. You know, he's very good at that. And I surround myself with a number of books. One of my favorite writers always is Samuel Beckett. Of course, that's that Irish connection again.
Yes.
He writes in a sparse way, and I like that. I like to go back to him and see how he writes. Beautiful writer, and so, but not easy to read. I don't want to imitate him, but I get inspired in a certain direction by these kinds of writers.
A Student of the Mystery, Thomas More. His latest book is A Religion of One's Own. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. For podcasting on iTunes, it's Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.